listening to the Forza Podcast with your host, Marsh.
All right. What up? It is the Forza Podcast. We're coming at you again, third time this week. We told you it happened and did it. It's me, your boy, Marsh. As always, I am joined by my wonderful producer and co-host, Jordan Nelson. Jordan, talk to me. How are we? How are we feeling?
We are doing good. We are a little fatigued from three podcasts in a week, but we are still hyped.
But you know what? I mean, we're built to weather the storm. I mean, we're just warriors, you know?
Oh yeah, dude. Well, I've spent the last 2 days chatting up with Kane's fam. Anyways, in the last 3 days, I've spoken to our dude, best friend of the podcast, Brad Tejeda. I've spoken to him twice. And today I also spoke with another friend of the podcast, Travis Bruce, on the phone. So it's been good, man. Lots of Canes this week for me.
Hey, good. I mean, because I've been out of it the last few days. I need you to carry it, man. Carry the brand.
Oh, you got it, brother.
But, I mean, I'm just really proud of us that we were able to pull this off. It was a big week for us, and we're going to finish it off tonight with two good guests. We got Cam Underwood. He's the managing editor of State of the U, also my boss. And so we're going to have him on first, and then we got Brad Coons. He was a member of the 2001 Hurricanes. He will join us in about 30 minutes. So what do you say, man? Let's get this going.
Cool. I'll patch Cam in right now, brother. Cam, what's up, man? You're live on the Fours Up podcast.
Yo, what's going on?
What's going on, Cam? We now welcome on my boss and the managing editor of the State of the U, Cam Underwood. Cam, thank you so much for joining us, brother.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
How are you doing with this whole coronavirus? How's South Florida treating you?
Man, you know, it's a different kind of situation, but just kind of been hanging out at home, playing some video games, still making my way into the secret day job a little bit here and there. Which, no, I'm not going to tell you guys. But, yeah, you know, just doing that and working on Cam's Cooking Corner, you know, that I'm a fledgling foodie. So got some new recipes working on and things like that and doing a little reading. Got a buddy who's down here for a while in Hollywood, your old stomping grounds, Marsh. So he's a musician like myself. So he's kind of spurred me into getting back into, you know, learning some stuff on the keys and whatnot. So, you know, just kind of doing those things, but taking it a day at a time. How about you guys?
I love it. I mean, I wish I was doing all that. I love to cook and play music and all that stuff, but I've just been sitting on my hands playing video games for the last 2 weeks.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, people want to talk bad about people playing video games, and now video games are helping save the world. So you guys are welcome.
That's right. Good deal. I need you to talk to my dad about that, please.
That's awesome. Cam, okay, so before we jump into Canes and football, Jordan and I are big Entourage fans, and I know you're a fan of the show. I know you don't like Johnny Drama. Why not?
Oh, man. I get it. Johnny Drama was the, you know, I mean, he is like the lesser known brother of a famous actor, first of all. So, like, you have that in real life, and he, like, kind of just played that role. And, I mean, he played it big. And obviously, like, Entourage, the acting was not really big on subtleties and things like that. So he was, you know, just very on the high end of it. And he whined just all the time about, like, I'm not getting enough, you know, exposure, and I'm not known enough. And, like, everybody's not going to be Vincent Chase. Everybody's not going to be the media star, you know, but he worked consistently. If you go through all the episodes and all the seasons of the show, Johnny Drama stayed with an audition. Johnny Drama stayed with a job. You know, he went everywhere. He went to San Diego Comic-Con every year. Why? Because Vikings was still iconic. You know what I mean? But he, like, overlooked all of that stuff. He's doing all these stupid games with Turtle and them. You know, they're over here chasing after girls and doing all the things. Which, again, if you look through the series like that we saw on Entourage, Johnny Drama was not necessarily hurting for female companionship either. So, but he's always crying about it as though, like, no one ever gave him an audition or a job, or no female ever looked his way a second time or anything. And it's like, bro, like, you have so many things that you're intentionally overlooking to complain, and it just got old for me.
Yeah, no, I'm actually with you there. The first time I watched the series, I didn't like Drama. But then the next time, you know, one of my good buddies said that Drama was his favorite. And so the next time I watched it through, I, you know, was trying to be a little more biased towards Drama and just, like, pay attention to him more.
Yeah.
And I did enjoy him a lot. But that's those are a lot of the same reasons why I can't stand Turtle. Because I think Turtle is the biggest mooch on the planet, and I can't stand it. Like, well, he's...
And, I mean, that was his role in the group. You know, he was just, like, the feel-good guy. Like, we want to have him around because he's one of our friends. Like, you know, the Chase brothers acted. E, eventually, he went out there. He's like, yo, I'm going to make it in the business. I'm going to manage people and whatnot. And Turtle was like, cool, I'm going to be here. You know, and that was it. And eventually, you know, like, you get to season 4 and season 5, and Turtle was like, okay, you know, let me try to do something, because he even felt that he was being a sponge. And I think that, you know, I think that Jerry Ferrara, the actual actor, he wanted more range to do something with his character, because it was very just comic relief, you know, slapstick, whatever, you know, jokey here, jokey there. And I think that a lot of people eventually, even if it was subconsciously, started to feel like, okay, like, everybody else in the show is doing something other than Turtle, who plays video games and smokes weed exclusively. Not now. And again, I know that people are going to listen and say, Cam, you just said the video game is taking over the world or helping save the world. Yeah. But he did that exclusively along with smoking weed. He didn't add really any other value. And I mean, he had some great jokes and some great one-liners, but eventually he had to grow out of that, the actor and the character. But I could see why, at a time, he was definitely the biggest mooch in the world, because that was his function in their group of friends.
Yeah, and it was when you'd complain, like the Fukijama episode where he gets the custom Air Force Ones from the graffiti artist.
Oh, yes.
When he was like whining about that and stuff, and like trying to make Vince feel guilty and stuff, I'm just like, Turtle, what is going on, brother? Like, you have the best life on the planet. You do nothing,
right.
And you have all of the movie star privileges.
Like, right, but if you think about it, that was the first time. But that was the first time that he wasn't able to cash in the Vincent Chase card.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he thought he had a great life, or I mean, which he did, you know, but he thought, like, cool, I got Vincent Chase. Yeah. It doesn't matter that we're going to Undefeated, we're going to Flight Club or anywhere, you know, you got to stay online for da-da-da. It don't matter. Why? Because Vincent Chase has been my homeboy since homeboys were homeboys, like way back in the day. So we're going to roll up, stroll up. You're going to see this movie star that I'm with get goo goo gaga. I'm going to walk in there, go get my Fukijamas and be good. Yeah. And then Vince was like, nah, we're going to be out here like regular people, because you and I are regular people. And that threw Turtle for a loop, because he was expecting the movie star privilege and he didn't get it. And that was one of the first times that you saw any kind of disconnect, any kind of pushback between, you know, like him and Vince, or like what he thought. And yeah, I mean, it was totally first world problems. Like, oh, I'm complaining about some Fukijamas that I didn't get, and then got one of one exclusives. But I mean, it's 30 minutes of bro time. You know, it's cameos, sneakers, cars, you know, women, and like very, very thinly tied together with a plot of some acting intrigue at the high end of Hollywood. Like, that's what that show's about.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love it. It's my favorite show, arguably, that and Scrubs. But anyways, we should probably move on to some Kane stuff.
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I could talk Entourage all day, but, you know, I don't know who out there else wants to hear that. So Marsh told me that you were a student at UM during the turn of the century, I guess. What years were you a student?
I was a freshman in 2000, graduated in 2004.
Okay.
So we lost the second game my freshman year at Washington and did not lose again until game 8 or 7 of senior year at North Carolina on the Connor Barth field goal.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So my question is, like, describe to us and the audience what it was like to be a student at the premier football program or football school in the country. Like, what was the vibe around campus, or what was being in the student section? What, I mean, just tell me that. That's my dream, you know?
Oh, man, it was awesome. Yeah, I mean, just like the energy started probably about, you know, Thursday morning-ish. You know, people usually didn't have many classes on Friday. Not unfortunately, but I was a music student, so I had multiple classes on Fridays. So, you know, everybody would hit to the rat after their 11 o'clock for that noon hour. My last class on Friday was noon to 1, so you're going in there maybe a little bit hour later. But starting from, yeah, Thursday morning, the energy just started. And again, Miami always had a Thursday night home game, usually. Thursday night game. So that is going to kick off the week. You know, you're watching ESPN Thursday Night Football, but like you just, we're the biggest, baddest dudes on the block. You know what I mean? And it was just, it was awesome. You know, I had several friends who were on the team, you know, classes with other guys. I've told a story of having a class with a certain football player on, I won't say what position, I won't say what side of the ball, but just suffice it to say that if I were to say this person's name, you would know who I'm talking about. Okay. To this day. Yeah. You know this person. And it was Philosophy 130, Contemporary Moral Issues, my freshman year. So we're sitting there, you know, syllabus day, whatever, whatever. You know, just getting the lay of the land, scoping out the class, whatever. And we had an adjunct professor, and he calls roll, and everybody knew this guy's name. So, yeah. Like, the whole class in concert says, you know, player name. And he's like, oh, is he famous or something? You're like, oh, you must be new here. Yes, everybody knows him. But he comes in 15 minutes late, sits down next to a very attractive young lady, you know, just interrupting, whatever, cool, just hanging out. And the professor gets to the end of his spiel about his syllabus. Say, oh, is there any questions? Dude's hand goes up, football player. Oh, yeah, the famous guy. Cool, I'll call on you. And goes, hey, yeah, so what's your tennis policy? Here? He said, I'm sorry? Said, what's your tennis policy? Here? Said, oh, but the it's like somebody else translated, like the tennis policy. Go ahead and tell him. He goes, oh, I mean, it's as long as I get your assignments and you're here for the tests, I mean, that's fine for me. Oh, all right. Leans over, takes out his cell phone, gets the number from the young lady next to him, and raises up to leave. And the professor was like, whoa, 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 hey, whoa, buddy, where you going? He said, wait, nah. You said as long as you got my assignments, I'm here for the test, right? Right? All right, then. And walked straight out of class, first day. And we did not see this player never again that semester. I might have told that on Twitter a while ago. I might have dropped whose name that is, so maybe you go back through my Twitter archives. I'm not going to say it on here. But, I mean, you had things like that, you know, like my buddy Matt Carter, he was the holder on extra points and field goals. He took over the number 11 after Ken Dorsey. He was the one who told us after the special teams meeting on that Wednesday before the Florida game in 03, he goes, Devin Hester wants the ball. We're like, yeah. He goes, no. He came in the meeting and said, if we win the toss, take the ball, I'm going to go score. And my friend Matt sometimes embellishes things. I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever. And I was in the student section in 03 for that opening kickoff return, and that was the loudest I personally had ever heard the Orange Bowl. It was electric. It was incredible. And there's stories like that I have for days, just the memories being there in the Orange Bowl, sitting. I did not get there early enough to get into the student section for the 2000 Miami Florida State game, but I was in the building, and, you know, being a musician, I'm attuned to all the musical cues and things of life. And I'd heard that damn war chant like a billion times, because everybody hears it, you know, between the Kansas City Chiefs, the Washington Redskins, the Atlanta Braves, Florida State, like, you know, everybody, you've heard that chant. So I'm like, okay, cool. And we were up, I think 7-0 or something like that. And the whole stadium is going crazy. It's like 98,000 people. They have the extra stands in the end zone. Everything's going crazy. And you see one person stand up in the upper deck, and you hear that god darn whistle that you can hear from 18 miles away. Deep, 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 deep. And you just hear the drum fill coming in. And then it was the fire of 1,000 suns. Like, it was 455 members of that marching band, and it was just a wall of sound, the likes of which I've never heard. Oh, my God. And I mean, but they were where I was sitting. They were pointed directly at me. They were not pointed at the student section, because it was at the end of the horseshoe. so it was pointed towards midfield. So they were basically playing across the 40 or across the 30-yard line directly to my seat. It was beyond. I mean, and then, of course, you talk about that iconic game, you know, big-time players, Santana Moss, you know, Jeremy Shockey over the middle, you know, just all the players that we got to see at the Orange Bowl, man. It was just it was incredible. I mean, and honestly, I mean, I went to every game in undergrad. You know, sometimes, you know, the stadium would be empty by the third quarter because we're up by 40 points already. You're going to go back to drink with your boys, you know, if you got, you know, some other social plans. Hint, hint. You maybe want to go enact those a little early. But, I mean, like, it was a thing where there was not – like, if you're a Miami Hurricanes fan now, the question in your brain every week is, will Miami do what Miami needs to do to be competitive? That's what you think every time they step on the field now. Then in 2000, it was how much are we going to whoop these fools by? It was not a question of whether we were going to win or lose. It was, okay, I mean, is freshman Frank Gore going to go for 135 in the fourth quarter again, or is he going to get it in the third quarter? It was basically playing NCAA, the video game, on freshman level. Like, you're getting ridiculous player development because you're getting all the young guys in early. You're just showing out. You're looking for stats. You know, let's make sure that we have the starters get 7 touchdowns by the half so we can get out of here. I mean, yeah, it was all of that and more. It was the perfect storm. And like, I knew that we were great when I was there, but I didn't really know how great until a little bit later.
I mean, the way that you describe it, I mean, cause I mean, we've obviously talked to him and I'm always jealous. Going forward to 2020, I remember last summer, I think it was on the Mark Rogers show, you predicted 10-2 because of the schedule and everything. And obviously we did not go 10-2. How are you feeling this year? I mean, are you still like, is that confidence back because of De'Aaron King, or are you at the point where you're like, you know what, this team, I just got to see it.
7-5. Prove me wrong. I'm not going off of that, because fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame. I mean, really not going to happen. But they have fooled me a couple of times. And I've always said it comes down to the teams. It comes down to Miami doing what Miami needs to do. And that's why earlier, after we beat down Florida State again, and then we beat them so bad that they fired Willie Taggart, and they were talking about who they're going to get for head coach, I wrote that piece on State of the U where I said, I don't care about Florida State. I don't care who they hire. It could be Bob Stoops. It could be Nick Saban. I don't care what they do over there. I care about what we do in our building, orange and green and white, wearing that iconic U on that white helmet. I don't care what those guys do. And if Miami handles business, it really honestly usually doesn't matter what the other team does. But the thing about it is Miami has played so far below the level of their talent for so long that I cannot take them at their word that they're going to do what they say that they're going to do. I cannot just say, okay, cool. Like, we have all of this talent. We have by far the most talent in the ACC Coastal, and we're going to just walk to it. We should, but we have not played like that. So now I'm going to go to the other end. 7-5, prove me wrong. Prove to me that this team that has quit on coaches in 5 of the last 7 years, this team that has been very terrible, that lost to Duke in consecutive years for the first time in program history, that lost to FIU anywhere ever on the face of this earth for the first time in program history, prove to me that that's not this same team. And that's going to happen by you going out there on, well, one Friday and a bunch of Saturdays and doing the work. And until I see it, I'm not going to believe it. So call me a hater, call me Doubting Thomas, whatever. Call me from Missouri, because you got to show me before I believe it.
No, I mean, dude, I mean, everyone knows that I've been very critical, and I'm sometimes viewed as a negative fan. But I mean, I don't know. Now you say 7-5. I'm saying I went up to 9-3 once we got De'Aaron King. I mean, where do you see those 5 losses? I mean, obviously you got North Carolina. That's going
to
be tough.
We're not. I mean, look, we lost to teams that we've literally never lost to before last year. Show me a game on the schedule that's not a potential loss. Until this team goes and does what this team needs to do. And I know people are going to say, look, Cam, you're overreacting. You said 10-2 last year. They, you know, didn't do that. You know, 2018 wasn't great either. You're a little bit in your emotions. Cool, I'm an emotional guy. Prove to me that I should be invested in a 10-win Miami team, that I should realistically believe that that is possible.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right in there. I mean, in my brain, I can't really see us losing to UAB. But for the Temple game,
that's a 9-win team. Temple, I mean, obviously we got their best player off of their roster. Yeah. I'm sorry to cut you off, but like you could, if this is Miami of years past, you could talk all of that away. But we've done that for years. Last year, what I mean, that's why I started writing after the third game, fourth game. This is a fireable offense because there were so many things that were fireable from this, you know, from the season. You know, like, yes, it does it stand to reason that a team with this much talent in all of these places struggles the way that we have over the course of the last 15 years? No, it doesn't make sense. But sometimes you can't make sense out of nonsense. And that's been the production and the performance of the Miami Hurricanes for a long time. So it is easy to go down the mental path of we have more players or we have better players here than other places. You have Rhett Lashley coming in and talking about, I had James Prochet go for 1,300 yards as a wide receiver at SMU, and he was running 4.65, 4.7. And then I come here and I see these guys running 4.4s, 4.3s. So you obviously extrapolate that out to think, cool, if I had a guy running 4.7 with this kind of production, oh my holy God, what can we do with guys with this kind of speed? Yeah, you might put up some numbers on the scoreboard, but like, look, we lost to one of the worst teams in captivity last year, FIU. We lost to another one of the worst teams in captivity, Georgia freaking Tech last year. You found a way to lose to them? Like, nah. I mean, it is easy to go down the mental path of thinking that Miami could and should be more productive in terms of wins than they have been. But again, we've said that so many times that it rings hollow to me. I have to see that kind of performance. Now, if we don't have 9 or 10 wins in this regular season, then we got to circle back and talk about Manny Diaz's job, honestly and truly. Because if last year was tailor-made for a 10-win season, which it was, and it was your first turn ever as head coach, and you found a way to go be worse after every subsequent bye week, to lose to a worse team coming off of a bye every time that you had one, you lose to Florida, and that's a pretty good team, and that was a close loss. But then you lose to North Carolina, Georgia Tech, and Virginia Tech all coming off byes. What? Or FIU was in there, I think. I mean, like, four of those losses were terrible, and they all came off of byes, but the performance was worse every subsequent time after a bye when you're saying, oh, we figured this out, we figured that out. You figured less than nothing out, buddy. But now you come back again and have even more talent this year than last, and you have a proven quarterback, have a proven offensive coordinator who was even doing numbers at Connecticut. Think about how hard that is on offense. And he comes down here, and you have another six loss season. And that's a conversation that we're going to have.
Yeah. And I I'm going to ask you a question. We had Justin, another writer from State of the U, on the other day. I asked him this. And I want to ask you this, Cam. Do you think Manny is that guy? Can he be the guy? We can talk about that forever. But do you think he is that guy?
I think that this season is going to prove one way or the other on that. I think he has traits of being that guy. I think that his willingness to change course when needed, because obviously everybody saw that the offense that wasn't working. No. We got to course correct now because the results are not supporting continuing this process. I appreciate the move for that. I appreciate the move to update the staff as appropriate. I like his forward-looking mentality as kind of optimism in the moment. But there's also the performance on the other side. So I get all the sound bites and things. He says the right things. It seems to me that he's made a move at the right time. We'll see if that move is right. But I think that the move to Rhett Lashley and Garen Justice as offensive line coach, that's going to tell the story of Manny Diaz's tenure. So either we get things going in a real good direction right now or nah. But I'm on the fence. I think that he has traits of being that guy. I need to see if the moves that he's made towards that end actually bear fruit.
Well, I got one last question for you. So Marsh tells me that you're very knowledgeable when it comes to recruiting. So I've been wanting to to know this answer. Do you think the class that we put together after a horrible season, is that something that Manny can repeat? Or do you think that kids will get the message?
I'm gonna cut you off now. No, we're not going to pull another top 15 class with another 6 and 7 year. You got the first year bump from a first year head coach, which everybody has written about as being a tangible thing, whether it's Bud Elliott, formerly with us at SB Nation, now at 247, whether it's other writers either at 247 or Rivals, even other guys in the SB Nation network. There's a tangible jump in recruiting performance the first year, the first full cycle of a new head coach. And we saw that last year. And you had, obviously, you know, some of those long-term relationships, because obviously Manny Diaz was on staff here for 3 years prior. So getting a Navonte Williams was a four-year recruitment, and you still had the same point guy here between Bonda and Diaz, or point guys, I should say, the whole entire time. And I get it, because they're seeing maybe they can be part of the change, and you are the new coach. It's like, cool, I get that, you know, Mark Richter's here and everything, but like, I'm here. We need you to move forward in this positive direction, yada, yada, yada. So, boom, bah. So you're going to get some of those guys. Now you got to win, bro. Like, period. And it just, there, the list of elite players in South Florida is long and distinguished, and that is the same every year. But you're going to keep losing guys. You know, Marcus Tate, five-star left tackle from U school in Fort Lauderdale, already committed to Clemson. Clemson has two decommitments in the last 8 years, and one of them actually ended up at Clemson. So we have one guy who's committed there, who's decommitted and went elsewhere, and he went to Auburn in the last, like, 8 or 9 years. Guys who commit to Clemson go to Clemson. So you've already lost a five-star left tackle prospect from your own backyard. You're going to lose more of them unless you go win games.
All right. That you said it perfectly, man. I wish we had more time to chat, Cam. But thank you so much for coming on, brother. You know, I appreciate you. We got to have you on again, man. And once I get back down to Hollywood, we got to hit up those food trucks again.
Man, you know, I think the food trucks have been suspended indefinitely for quarantine reasons. But yeah, when you're back down and those are able to be part of the rotation, we'll hit it up, man.
Good deal, brother. Well, hey, thank you again for coming on. You're welcome on anytime, and we'll chat. Well, I mean, I talk to you pretty frequently, but we'll chat again soon on the pod.
Got it, man. Thank you guys for having me. Be sure that you guys go check us out at stateoftheu.com. That's my only plug. I'll see you.
Hey, thanks, Cam. Go Canes.
Appreciate it. Go Canes.
All right, perfect, man.
That was a great interview.
Dude, that was Cam, man.
Cam kicks ass.
Holy moly, yeah. Like, I, you know, I can see why he's the managing editor at State of the U now, Leo. You just need to talk to him a little bit about Canes football, and he's just knows everything. Holy crap.
Yeah, that was like a shot of B12.
Oh, yeah, dude. It was like, I asked a question, and he answered every single facet of the question. Every angle that I could hit it from, he took care of it for me, so... That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, he just knows his stuff, man. And so we got one more guest coming on. It's Brad Coons. Is he ready, Jordan?
I think he's going to need just a few moments. Let me double check. No, he should be good.
Cool.
I'm going to patch him in right now.
Hello?
Hey, you there, Brad?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, man. How you doing?
Okay, I'm great. How you doing?
Good. So we're live here on Fours Up. Okay. Thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, it's my pleasure. It's a great thing, man.
Good. All right. Well, hey, we now welcome on is it Coons? How you say your last name? Or?
Yeah, Coons.
Cool. So, yeah, we welcome on former University of Miami offensive lineman Brad Coons and member of the 2001 National Championship team. Thank you so much for coming on and talking some Canes with us, brother.
Hey, I'm excited, man. You know, I love the name of your podcast, because it's, you know, Fours Up. I mean, that's something we live for. And I was always – one thing that I always did was we were in the Orange Bowl and it was the fourth quarter – and, you know, part of this was because I wasn't a starter. I had the ability to do this, but I would literally hold up the four fingers until I saw every other set of four fingers drop in the stadium. So I love the name.
Hey, we appreciate that, man. And you know, let's get right into it. So you played from your freshman year was 2000, and then you told me your last game was the Peach Bowl win against the Gators after the or during the 04 season, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So, I mean, talk to us. I mean, you were a part of one of the great football dynasties in all of college football history. What was that like? I mean, going into the heck every day knowing that your goal is the national championship. What was that like with those high expectations?
Well, I think for me, I came from a small town in southern Illinois of about 3,000 people. And so, you know, a part of what you know, I had going on for me and benefited me is I didn't know any better. You know what I mean? Like I didn't know in the moment how amazing things really were. And so, you know, I came to work and I listened to the guys and, you know, the culture that we had on that team was so unbelievable. And, you know, you take it for granted when you're a part of it. But it's something you don't see very often where, you know, every guy on the team is treated the same. You know, like I was probably in the top 100 guys on the team. And, you know, Ed Reed and everybody else would treat me exactly the same. And we would push each other exactly the same. And, you know, we also had this culture of we wanted people that were younger than us to take our jobs if that meant we were going to be better. And so, that's something you don't see a lot nowadays, and that's what it took to be that great of a dynasty at that time.
So, I mean, being on that team, you would have been in the same position room as Bryant McKinney, and in practice and drills, I mean, you'd be going up against guys like Vince Wilfork, and I mean, just the other incredible defensive players that we had there in the front seven. I mean, what was that like? Was there guys that you'd go up against them in practice or see them in drills and, I mean, just think like, holy crap. Like, I did not know that humans were made like that. I mean, tell me about stuff like that.
Yeah, I you know, that was every day, you know, especially my first 3 years. My junior year, I wasn't on scout team anymore. But, you know, those first 3 years going against Vince Wilfork, William Joseph, you know, Andrew Williams, Jerome McDougal, Jamal Green, you know, it was, you know, Dan Morgan, John Vilma, DJ Williams. I mean, that was every day, you know, and it was awesome. I mean, that's the thing people don't think about when they look at our guys' NFL careers. When we played ones versus ones in practice, it was, you know, a game. You know, we played at that high of a level. And so there are guys that their careers were probably shortened because of the competition they saw in practice every day at Miami, to be honest. But, you know, it was definitely something that, you know, you can't help but appreciate. You know, in the moment, you don't really realize it. You know, when you get hit by Dan Morgan and you're trying to block him and he goes and makes a tackle, you know, that's, you don't appreciate that in the moment, but looking back, you're like, wow, that was, you know, that was some really awesome things.
I mean, I'm getting just chills hearing you talk about this. And during your career, and I think my statistics are correct, you went undefeated against Florida State all the years that you were there, correct?
And Florida.
Yep. And so, I mean, those were, so 2002, I went to my first Canes game. It was the Florida State game, and that's when I really got introduced to that rivalry, and I've hated Florida State with a passion ever since. What was that? I mean, because that's back when, I mean, both teams were ranked in the top 10. Tell the audience what it was like with that rivalry game, you know, the week leading up, getting into the Orange Bowl or going into Doak Campbell Stadium in Tallahassee. What was the intensity like with that rivalry game and the importance of that?
Well, you know, first off, when that week started, the Florida State chant music would be being played in our locker room. And, you know, there were many of us that would, back in the day when we had Napster and all those MP3 downloading things, we would pull up the FSU fight chant. I think actually Chris Ricks had a website for like himself to promote like himself as a player, and I think it had the background music. So we would literally put that website on and just let it play and just stay focused with that. You know, it was definitely, you know, everything was intense, and you know, it was something we wanted. But I'll never forget the first year we beat him in 2000. You know, Butch Davis is our head coach. He told us that he met, I guess it was like maybe 2 years prior, he met Bobby Bowden in the middle of the field. And Bobby Bowden, I don't think he meant to say it like this, but he basically said, it's a shame this isn't a rivalry anymore. And so I think that really motivated him and motivated our players. And you know, in that meeting, he talked about it. We all got these shirts that said 10-7-0-0 for the date of that game. And I think I still have mine somewhere. But I mean, it you know, we wanted to win that game, and you know, for us to come out wide right three, you know, the drive at the end, Shockey getting that touchdown, it was a pretty amazing experience for my first taste of FSU. And then, you know, 2002 was wide left, and you know, again, just a crazy game. You know, everybody is in it the entire time, no matter how good one team is or the other. You know, but it was a knockout drag out fight. And one thing that people don't always talk about, and this is just kind of a funny thing that, but that 2002 game you were at was Jay-Z and Beyonce's first date. They were at our game on the sideline.
That's a true story.
Yeah. You can look it up on, you can search it on the internet. You can see a newspaper article, but yeah, they were there on the sideline, and you know, it was just a cool thing, and you know, but yeah, I was at that game.
Awesome. So our previous guest that we just had on a few moments ago before you, he was a student the same years that you were a player, actually, from 2000 to 2004.
Okay.
And we asked him what it was like to be on campus and be a student, you know, during this incredible time in the history of Miami football, and just what the culture was like, and you know, just the hype surrounding the team and the games, and so what's it like from the player's perspective? I mean, how did you get treated on campus, and you know, what was it like being college football royalty for 4 years?
Well, you know, I think the coolest thing was that, you know, and I don't hope this doesn't sound bad, but it was like there were the athletes, and then there were people that could afford to go to Miami. You know what I mean? And yeah. So a lot of times, you know, we'd be walking around in our sweats and you know, our issued gear, and you know, everybody else in class is dressed up like they're ready to go out on South Beach or something at the night, you know. And so it was, you know, there was definitely a division in that you could see that there were, that we were kind of out on our own, but you know, the respect we got from people, and you know, the camaraderie, I mean, I think I had as many friends at Miami that were not athletes that I did that were, even though at that time every sport was at the HEC, so it was almost like its own little community there, with the training room, the weight room, we all shared everything. And so, you know, everybody kind of had each other's backs. It was honestly hit or miss with professors if they wanted, you know, football players in their class or not. But you know, we always had the best people helping us and the most support possible. But you know, it was awesome to have, you know, classes with people, and you get to meet them, and you know, I still have friendships with some of them, and it's an awesome thing.
That's the greatest. I love hearing these kind of stories. And I mean, I grew up loving the Canes. I still obviously have a bad obsession with the Hurricanes because I love them so much. And I just love hearing about those good old days. One of my favorite parts about those teams, was your quarterback, Ken Dorsey. I think he's one of my favorite Hurricanes of all time. And I think you – to become the greatest team in college football history, you got to have that leader at quarterback. Dorsey, he didn't have the best arm. He wasn't a guy like Cam Newton. He wasn't a guy, you know, like Baker Mayfield. He didn't have all the intangibles, but he still led that team. Talk about Ken Dorsey as, you know, a quarterback, as a leader, and just that guy who could control that team.
You know, between Dorsey and Ed Reed and Joaquin Gonzalez, I mean, those three were kind of the leadership core of that team. And, you know, Dorsey, again, going with the idea that, you know, everybody's treated the same. You know, I actually had the opportunity to, like, go golfing with him and do other things and had a decent friendship with him. And, you know, it was – he just was so committed, and, you know, it was what he was there for. And he wasn't, you know, trying to go out and party a whole bunch. And, you know, he had his wife now, which was his girlfriend at the time, played soccer. And so, I mean, he was committed to everything that you could be committed to. And, you know, we'd have our summer workouts, and, you know, he would run the offense, and, you know, Ed Reed would run the defense. And those summer 7-on-7s were as intense as, you know, anything you'd see. But just his leadership, his sacrifice, his, you know, willingness to say what's needed when it needs to be said. You know, he was never shy to talk and get people fired up. And he just commanded everybody's respect. You know, there was nobody that would listen to Ken Dorsey and what he had to say and not want to do that for him, because they knew how committed he was. And so that's like the biggest thing with him, is just the commitment level. And I think the level-headedness, because, you know, I mean, he could have gone out as a junior. That was the thing. Like, everybody was thinking he was going to leave as a junior, because he was actually projected like first round as a junior. And he wanted to stay because he said, you know, I don't think that I am going to get that good of a look in the NFL. And he's like, I want to work my arm strength and these other things. And he decided to stay for his senior year. So, I mean, we're all really thankful he did that. But, you know, he was, again, committed and just a leader of beyond all leaders. I mean, if you talk about it like a field general, he's a field general.
So 2000, you guys, you know, obviously lose to Washington in week two, but then you rattle off. You know, I think it was 10 straight victories. You beat number one Florida State. You beat number two Virginia Tech. You deserve a shot to play in the national championship. You obviously, you don't get that chance, but you beat Florida. The next year, you guys become the greatest college football team of all time. Take me through that Rose Bowl against Nebraska and what, I mean, just all the emotions that came with it.
Well, for me, it had like special meaning, because I know it was like one of the first times that like any non Big Ten, Pac-10 team had gone to the Rose Bowl for like 50 years. And growing up in the Midwest, the Rose Bowl is all you hear about. And so getting a chance to go play in the Rose Bowl, I was excited. You know, that week, I mean, it was a fun week. We got to go to the Tonight Show with Jay Leno and meet him. And at that time, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with Regis Philbin was big, and they shot an episode that was like us versus Nebraska. That was really cool. You know, so the whole week leading up to it was a fun experience. A little less eventful than Bourbon Street in Florida, but that's a good thing. You know, we were pretty focused. And but, you know, that game, it was just a bizarre game, because we knew we were going to win. And, you know, it wasn't like we were, because, I mean, I'll admit there are losses that we had through my career there. I mean, we only had 7 or so of them. But in those losses, I mean, there were times that we played down the level of the competition and just couldn't wake up soon enough. Or we had games where we were behind and played to the level of the competition. You know, I think we were firing all cylinders that night. You know, we get that easy pass to Andre Johnson to start the game. Shockey's on fire. Portis is on fire. Our defense is stymieing them, you know. But, I mean, we were really well prepared for it. You know, I mean, this is one of my memories of the Rose Bowl week, is being on scout team, because every time that we would mess up, because we practiced at the Coliseum, at the USC Coliseum, every time that we would mess up, we would have to run all the way to the top of the Coliseum and come back. So, I mean, we were taking things seriously. We were running up the stairs a lot. But that game, you know, I mean, it was just surreal. And, you know, it was, you know, Shaquille O'Neal was on our sideline and, you know, it was crazy. And, you know, I mean, my personal story with it, you know, Joaquin Gonzalez, who's always the guy I kind of looked up to, the whole time I was there, and he wanted to carry Coach Coker onto the field. And so we get to the last play of the game and he puts me in for his spot, to go in for the kneel down. And so that was really cool for me, you know, as a redshirt freshman to get in and go be a part of that. And, you know, but again, the guys that went on to have NFL Hall of Fame careers and everything, you know, they celebrated with everybody that was on the team, you know, no matter who they were. And, you know, everybody kind of got treated equal and it was a brotherhood. And, you know, we wanted to win for each other and that's what we were going to do.
Awesome, man. I remember my question now. It's so we hear a lot about this 2001 team or even the 2000 or 2002 teams. We hear so much from, you know, former players and all the Hall of Famers and greats that were on that team. Is there anything that you can tell us that maybe we don't know that isn't common knowledge? You know, just something from the inside, even if it's a small detail, just something that resonated with you.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, I mean, a lot of great stories, you know, like, I think that the hard work we put in the summer, and I know Andrew Swayze's at FIU now, but I mean, he was kind of the unsung hero of everything because, you know, we talk about Dorsey and Ed Reed. I think a lot of times they took their cues from our strength coach, Andrew Swayze. And, you know, he would kind of shape the message, you know, and I think that was a big thing on that side of things. So I'll tell you this story because I don't know if I mentioned it or not on Twitter one time you were tweeting something, but Willis McGahee. So Willis was the best at everything he did. And he lived on my floor my freshman year. And I remember that, you know, he would walk into my room and never have played the video game I was playing, and he would get on the sticks and beat me. And so, like, I pretended like somebody stole one of my controllers so that I didn't have to play him if I knew he was coming. But, you know, he and I were kind of close. And that 2002 season, the first game he started, he borrowed my sandals to go use the bathroom before the game. And he did it the second game, the third game. So he did it all season. And it was kind of like his pregame ritual. And so we get to the Fiesta Bowl, and Coach Coker asked us to dress up that game. And so we get to the locker room, and he comes to me to get the sandals, and I didn't have the sandals. And just the look on his face, like, Coons, you didn't bring the sandals to the national championship game. You know, that was something that always stuck with me. And then the knee injury happened. Things just didn't go the way we wanted to. Everything was just kind of crazy. So that was probably something that, like, man, you know, you don't know if stuff like that happens, but, you know, it's not always something I like talking about, but, you know, we're past that far enough. And, you know, Willis and I have joked about it a few times since then. So,
and I was going to, I don't want to ask about that Fiesta Bowl, but I kind of just feel the obligation to. I mean,
yeah.
Just talk about that game, because I remember, I mean, I went to the Florida State game earlier that year, but that Fiesta Bowl is the first game I really remember watching with my father. I was living in Hollywood, Florida, and I was like 7 years old. He had to carry me to my room because I was just bawling hysterical. Just talk about that game a little bit.
Well, you know, we came out the first half, and, you know, the funny thing about it is, that was the most focused week of practice or anything we had done as a team. You know, guys that maybe even when we were at the Rose Bowl that went out and, like, you know, had a good time at night before curfew during that week, you know, they were staying home and being focused the entire time. So, you know, we were all fired up and ready to go, and we kind of came out flat. And, you know, after a whole season of not giving up a sack the entire time, you know, we gave up one early in the game, and, you know, things just weren't going the way we wanted to. You know, there was a ball tip that got intercepted, and, you know, for some reason we couldn't tackle Maurice Clarett. And, you know, all of a sudden we're at halftime not in the position we thought we would be in. So second half comes out, and, you know, we end up, I think it was 14-17. Roscoe Parrish makes a big return, gets us in field goal position. You know, and that was my job that year. I was on field goal PAT. And so we kicked a field goal with 3 seconds left. Todd Seaver makes it, sends us to overtime. That was probably the most nervous moment of my life personally, because I was like nervous, shaking, and I was like almost asking to get taken out because I was afraid I was going to jump off sides. You know, and to me, I look back at that moment, it could have been easily a Chris Webber moment. You know, imagine if I jumped off sides and we had to move the ball back 5 yards and missed that game tying field goal. You know, then there is no bad pass interference call. And, you know, it's me getting probably killed by some guys that had money on the game or something. But anyway, at least get some death threats. But, you know, we made that field goal. We went into overtime. We came down and scored, you know, and then we stopped them and we all celebrated, you know. And just like it says in the U part two, you know, I also remember Sean Taylor just throwing his helmet up as high as he possibly could, and it landed on the ground and all the pieces falling out of it. And, you know, us running on the field and like doing slides on the field and everything. And then we had to go back and play more game, you know. Obviously that was probably the worst call in football history. You know, and it stinks that's what our legacy for that year is, you know, not having Willis after the injury. And, you know, it's something that it still hurts. It's still something you think about and you still get angry about, even this far away from it, you know. But I mean, if we don't have that call and we get a couple extra BCS points that 2000 season, I mean, we could be a 3-time national champion team instead of a one, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were obviously the best team in all three of those seasons. This is my last question. Jordan probably has one last one. Okay, I'm gonna end my questioning on a happy note. 2001, okay. Doak Campbell Stadium, halftime, FSU, Ed Reed, I'm hurt, dog. What were you there for that? Like, or did you have to go on the field early for field goal practice?
No. So that was my redshirt freshman year. So I was not traveling at that time. I didn't travel that game. So, you know, that's the one game I wish I was there for, because I would have loved to have been there in that moment. But, you know, we were going into that game, and they had won like 50 straight or 40. 54 straight. So they were threatening our streak, and, you know, we wanted to leave there just decimating them. And that was kind of the goal. And, you know, we had a good first half. We were beating them. And you know, Ed's shoulder was bothering him. And he's like, yeah, I'm hurt, but we're going to put the gas to the pedal. Basically what he was saying is, you know, we're gonna keep pounding it and pouring it on them and leave them a game to remember. And, you know, and we did. And it was a great game for us. And, you know, it was, like I said, I wish that's one that I wish I could have been at. I got to travel, you know, my sophomore, junior, and senior year, but that was one I didn't get to go to. But, you know, it was definitely one of the bigger games of the year, because it just kind of set us up as, yeah, this is who we are. We're coming, and, you know, if you want some, come get some.
That's badass.
Yeah. So here's my last question. You're in a very – like, you're in a very small group of people that have been a part of the greatest team in their respective sport. You know, I do not entertain any arguments against that team being the best college football team of all time. So what I want to know is, how did being in such an elite group of guys, how has that changed your life since then?
Wow. I mean, as much as anything else, you know, as much as the recognition, anything, the lessons that I learned from those guys as I worked alongside of them in the weight room and, you know, at practice and in games and all that, like, that is what really has changed my life. Because being a part of, you know, those guys' lives and us all doing the things we had to do to get that to that point, that's truly what you take away from it. You know, it gives you a little bit of a cloud, a little bit of credibility, the fact that you were on that team. But it's like, not only was I on that team, but, you know, if anything else, just an education on how to be the best is what I take from that, you know, and the sacrifice, the demand, you know, guys like Brett Romberg or you know, Joaquin Gonzalez, and sitting in a room with them every day, and Bryant McKinney, and, you know, Chris Myers, Vernon Carey, all those guys, Eric Winston, you learn from those guys, and you see what makes them great, and, you know, you see them change over time. I mean, there are guys that came in that you're like, oh, that guy's not, you know, he's not going to cut it because he's not, you know, falling in line with us, but then you see them fall in line, and all of a sudden they're great, you know, and so that's the big thing for me, the big takeaway, you know. I mean, for me, it was kind of and I think this is everywhere, but when guys go on to the NFL, there's a time period where they're thinking that everybody wants something from them, you know? And so you lose a little bit of connection with some of those guys for a little bit, but then there's a sentimentalness that kind of sets in, and all of a sudden you have group chats with these guys, and you have, you know, Facebook, you know, groups and everything with them, and you start talking about the old times, and you see that they're still doing great things. And that's kind of the takeaway, the friendship and the lessons you learn.
That, I mean, like I said, man, like, Jordan and I were both diehard Hurricanes. I bleed orange and green. Like, this is what I love. I love talking to former Hurricanes, and because you guys did absolutely, you guys had a different mentality than all of college football. And we just want to see that mentality and that winning mindset return to Miami. But Brad, thank you so, so much for coming on. We would love to have you on again and tell some more stories. Cause I mean, I got hundreds of questions for you, but thank you again, brother. And hope everything is going well, you know, with you and your life. And thank you for being a Hurricane.
Hey, I appreciate it, man. It was the greatest time I could have had. And, you know, I appreciate you guys, and, you know, we're going to get back on track. There's a lot of good things going on, and, you know, I love what they're doing. So.
Hell yeah.
Well, thanks, Brad. And as right. always, go Canes, man.
Go Canes, baby.
That was amazing, man. I asked that last question, like, it just kind of clicked in my head, like, that like, Brad was on a team that their contemporaries are, like, the 72 Dolphins and the 96 Bulls. And that, like, gave me chills just thinking about it, man. Like, I can't imagine being a part of something like that. When you can look back and you're like, I am on the same... You know, I was a part of something that was as great as Michael Jordan at his peak, or at, you know, the greatest NFL season of all time. I mean, like, college football is, you know, it's a huge deal. And so to be a part of the greatest college football team of all time, it's just mind-boggling to think, man.
What a great way to end this week. I mean... Yeah. That was on. This has honestly been one of my favorite episodes. Like, going from Cam, who like he just is so, he just knows so much about the Hurricanes, and then going to someone like Brad, who actually played on those teams. Like I usually have so much to say, but like right now I'm just like, I'm very happy with this episode, and I don't know. I'm like, this. Yeah. It's one of those episodes where you're just like, damn, like, I'm happy. Like I'm really, really happy about this episode.
Dude, that the story that he shared with us about Willis McGahee and the sandals, man, that like that kind of hit me, especially as you know, he said that he doesn't really like talking about it. That man, I feel for him. So I really appreciate, you know, Brad, when you listen, I appreciate you sharing that with us, man. That's amazing stuff to hear, and you know, that's like intense Hurricanes lore, and you know, I just appreciate you sharing it with us, brother.
Yeah, that was we got to have both of those guys on again. I mean, I know I say that about every one of our guests because I believe that we've been very lucky with the guests that we've had on the show, and like just those stories that they're able to conjure up, and the feeling and the passion that they share about the program, because it's the same passion that we share. I mean, I want nothing else in this world than, I mean, like, I just want the Hurricanes to be good. Like, I have just so much passion about this program, and I love this, the University of Miami, with all my heart, even though they rejected me when I wanted to go to school there. It's just, I love talking about the Canes. Like I love it. Like and the juices are flowing. Like I could have recorded this for 3 hours tonight. Like and I came into the episode, I'm like, I'm a little tired, but like, damn, like I feel like I could go run a 4.44, 4.440. I could go bench 400 right now. Like I'm ready to go. Let's kick off, man.
Yeah. It's weird, man. It is weird to like, it's weird to have something that when you zoom out and you really think about it, like, you know, college football is kind of meaningless. When it comes to important things, you know, family and your safety and health and all that stuff. But I mean, man, I have such a respect and like reverence for the team, especially like that 2001 team, man. It hits different talking about that team and talking to Brad and hearing the stories, you know, like, If we win anytime soon, man, I will probably weep tears of joy. I really will. Like
I know I will cry. Like yeah. I was thinking about that the other day. I was watching. I'm bored, so I'm watching all like the documentaries about like, because I'm a Yankee fan too. I was watching documentaries about all these old Yankee teams that won, and I'm like, I love the Yankees with all my heart, but if the Canes were to win a national championship, like I don't know what I like.
Yeah.
I don't know what I will do.
Yeah, it's – and, you know, like, yeah, because I'm a huge Jazz fan as well. And I'm not sure I would, like, cry if the Jazz won. I think I'd just be more hyped, you know, like I'd be doing cartwheels on my front lawn and screaming at the top of my lungs and running around in circles and stuff. But I don't know. It's been tough being a Canes fan, you know. There's been a lot of tumult in the program in the last 20 years and – you know, being out here, like you know, you take a lot of crap for being a Canes fan when you don't live in South Florida and you don't have those connections. And, you know, I didn't really have any friends that were Canes fans growing up. So it was, you know, I was always on the defense, you know, like whenever football season came around, whenever we disappointed, I was always on the defense. There was no one to call and talk to. You know, like we do, where we're like, oh, man, this sucked. Like, yeah, that's a bummer. Like, I just had to internalize all of it, you know? So when we're good again, it'll be special, man. It'll be special, and I'm happy that I've made all these relationships with other Hurricanes fans that I'll be able to share that, you know, just how amazing it is. I'll be able to share it with people, so that'll be fun. I can't wait, man. I'm pumped.
We're getting so emotional right now. I mean, this is awesome. I mean, no. I just like I, it, it has been hard being a Hurricanes fan, especially guys our age who were too young when we were really that good. And we just know the past 15 years. But talking to guys like Cam and Brad, like it makes me realize why I love this program. And it makes me realize and remember, you know, like, yeah, we went 6-7 last year. It sucks ass. But I mean, we're still the University of Miami. Like this is like this will always be the U. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just saying that, but like, I don't know. Like, I wouldn't trade being a Canes fan and doing what I do right now for anything. Like, I get frustrated sometimes with Canes fans and things like that, but like at the end of the day, like I like just like I told Brad, like I bleed orange and green, man. Like this, yeah. Like this is everything.
Yeah, and you're right, man. It's been so hard. I mean, think about the last 20 years. I've been getting crapped on by guys like Matt Ryan and Eric Ebron and Marquise Williams. And I mean, what was the quarterback for Georgia Tech that ran for 400 yards on us or whatever?
Which one?
Yeah, that's a great point. The one in 2009, I want to say. I don't know. I can't think of the year. But anyways, it was one of those QBs. But dude, it's been tough. Like 2017 was the only time that I've ever like in the last 15 years felt that, and that's almost all of my fandom. You know, just when Bandy picked off that pass against Notre Dame and took it back to the house, that was a new experience for me. Like I wasn't old enough to process that back the last time we did it. So
yeah,
I mean, to think about that, that's crazy. Like yeah, that was
good stuff.
That was a new feeling when that happened, and I haven't felt it since. I can tell you that much.
But you know what? We are going to feel it. We're going to feel it again. I know it. Like, I know that, like, as much crap as I give the Canes, because I know I can be a little negative sometimes. That's something I'm trying to work on, everyone. So if you hear me, I'm working on it. But, like, I don't know. Like, deep down in my heart, I know that we will get back to where we were. I mean, all the big schools have done it. Alabama, Notre Dame, like, Michigan. Like, they've come back and done it. Why the hell can't we do it? Like, so.
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, those, we face a different set of challenges than those schools do though.
Yeah.
So I hope that we can, and man, just, I don't know what it will take. I mean, it's hard to diagnose what's wrong, whether it's the players or the coaches or the administration, you know, the athletic directors or the boosters. I mean, we've had so many different faces come through all of those spots in the last few years, and we've always had the same result. You know, we even had a legend pass through here, and he was able to fix it for like 1.5 years, and then the wheel kind of came off. You know, like Mark Richt was a legend when he got hired here, man. And then I mean, we kind of killed his career, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and we sent him into retirement. We forced him into retirement.
Yeah, and like, I mean, think about the state of a program that a legend goes to a legendary program. I guess for our generation, he's a legend, right? I'm not sure he's an all-timer, but, you know, a legendary coach goes to a legendary program, and we kind of, you know, slammed the door shut on his career, and that's – it just makes me sad, dude. We need to figure it out. Who knows? Maybe – you know, I hope it is Manny. I definitely think it can be. But, you know, there's a few guys out there that are employed by different schools that, you know, they might have it in them if it's not Manny. So,
yeah. Yeah, man.
We just need to have the testicular fortitude to make it happen. You know, like
I don't know what the hell that means, but yeah, I like it.
We need to have the balls, man.
There, like, you go.
If it doesn't work out with Manny, we need to have the balls to go, like, to just drop a bag full of gold bricks on Mario Cristobal's desk and be like, hey, come make it happen here, man. Like, it's I mean, I don't know. Who even knows if that could happen, you know? Oregon kind of has a better setup than we do, so.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's the same. But you know what? I mean, I just want sports to return. That's what I'm focused on. Yeah. What was your – I know we were talking before the show. What's your John Elway thing?
Oh, yeah. So here's an NFL question, because I love the NFL. It's a popular debate on Twitter now, who are the top 5 QBs of all time. And so John Elway is number 2 all time in Super Bowl starts for a quarterback. He went 2-3 in his career. So 5 starts. I think Brady has what, 7 or 8? I think he has 8 because he lost 2 to, yeah.
He has 9.
Oh, he has 9.
Because he lost twice to the Giants and then lost to the Eagles as well. And he has 6 wins.
Wow, that is a lot of Super Bowls, man. Holy crap. Here's my question. It's pretty safe to say that Brady is going to finish as the greatest quarterback of all time. So if you swap John Elway and Tom Brady, John Elway gets to play with Bill Belichick and the Patriots for the last 18, 19 years. Does he have a better – so does he replicate what Brady did or better? Or do you think the Patriots have less success?
If Elway was in Brady's spot?
Yep. Same exact – everything is the same. Same coaching. You know, Belichick and Robert Kraft, and you have all these same teams, the great defenses. You know, Randy Moss, Wes Welker, Gronk, all that stuff. All things being equal, does John Elway have as good of a career or better than Brady?
No. And I'll tell you, I'm a huge, huge Tom Brady fan. I mean, I wrote my freaking thesis senior report on why Tom Brady's the greatest quarterback of all time. Look at Brady's first Super Bowl victory. He was a second-year quarterback, and that team was trash. I would challenge anyone to name me three offensive players. Like, do you remember the running back from Brady's first Super Bowl win?
Hold on, let me see. Was it Corey Dillon? No, it wasn't Corey Dillon, was it? No, I can't name him right now. Who was it?
Well, I think it was Antoine Smith and then J.R. Ridley or something like that. They had two running backs. But the point of the fact is that team sucked. And, like, there were so many times where Brady took his team. Like John Elway, he didn't perform when it came to the Super Bowl. When time came to perform, Tom Brady always did. And he always showed up. And John Elway was absolutely a better athlete, and he probably had a greater arm. I'm a big John Elway fan, too. I think he's very underrated nowadays. But you have to have that mindset that Tom Brady had. Like, when you're playing the Rams in his first Super Bowl, like, he was going to take his team down and, you know, get in position for Adam Vinatieri to kick that field goal. And, like, there were so many times in that Patriots dynasty where Brady – I mean – Brady was down 28-3 to the Falcons, and they came back. I mean, John Elway, I mean, he got destroyed in those first three Super Bowls, like, absolutely manhandled.
Arguably the greatest dynasty in NFL history, though, with the Niners, and then the Giants had Lawrence Taylor, and, you know, I guess those Redskins.
Well, I mean, but also think about the fact that Brady's first Super Bowl was against a Rams team that was going for their second championship in 3 years. I mean, the greatest show on turf. They had Kurt Warner, Marshall Faulk, Torrey Holt, Isaac Bruce. Like, that team was so much better than that Patriots team. And, like, the Patriots somehow did it. And, like, you're going to tell me that John Elway and those Broncos, like, they couldn't beat the Redskins in that Super Bowl? They had Doug Williams, and no disrespect to Doug Williams, but he wasn't that great. No one knew who he was, and that team, like, just that Broncos team just fell apart. And so, no, I don't think that that whole argument with, like, oh, well, if you put Aaron Rodgers, like, in the Patriots system, like, he'll have, like, 7 or 8 Super Bowls. I don't think that. It's so much more than throwing a simple pass. It's like, Tom Brady is, I don't. He was like he's like a Ken Dorsey. Ken Dorsey. There were so many quarterbacks better than that guy. I mean, Carson Palmer at the time at USC, and Chris Winkie better than Ken Dorsey in college. But, like, Ken Dorsey was able to control that team and make them believe what they were capable of doing. I think Tom Brady had that. Obviously, I mean, 9 Super Bowl appearances, 6 Super Bowl wins. That's an NFL record. That's ridiculous. You can't go and say, okay, well, if John Elway did that, he would have also gone to 9 Super Bowls. I don't think that's true at all. And so, I'm kind of rambling here, but no,
I think you made a pretty convincing argument. I would definitely not be so decisive in my answer. I think the argument's there. I mean, Elway has sustained for a long time. I mean, there was like a 12-year period where he was taking teams to the Super Bowl, and that's probably second to Brady. You know, so it would be interesting to just see the infrastructure, because, I mean, Elway's years were mostly under Dan Reeves and Mike Shanahan, and, I mean, neither of those guys are Bill Belichick, like, or even close.
And then their great coach. I love Dan Reeves. I mean, he took some incredible teams to the Super Bowl, never won it. But, like, if you think about it, John Elway needed a guy like Terrell Davis to win a Super Bowl. I mean, you look at John Elway's first Super Bowl victory. I think he threw for under 100 yards. That was Terrell Davis. I mean, Tom Brady, he took that. Sorry, go ahead.
I said, I think Terrell Davis, wasn't he NFL MVP that season, had 2,000 yards?
That was the year after when they won the second Super Bowl. But, like, okay. I mean, like, that's, like, just proving the point. Like, he needed a guy like that, like a sidekick to – or not a sidekick, but, like, an extra piece to take that team to the next level. Tom Brady won his first Super Bowl through to guys like David Patton and Troy Brown and, like, guys who you have never heard of and you haven't heard of since. Like, his best receiver in 04 was David Givens. Like, he would continue to take the Patriots to AFC Championship games. Well, I mean, he had Randy Moss for 2 years. Like, that's it. So,
That's fair. I'll admit now, you know, I'm a little biased. I got a whole bunch of Elway memorabilia in my room. So, you know, the truth comes out. But yeah, man, it's good talk though, and we should post this on Twitter and get some conversation about it. But
yeah,
you know, Elway was my number one in terms of greatest of all time until Manning and Brady both kind of hit that level around the same time. I think it's hard to say that those two aren't top three all time. I mean, as much as I hate to say, you have to give it to Brady as the best. I'm not really a Brady fan. Then Manning has to be in the top three as well. I think when you're talking top three QBs of all time, it's guys like Elway and Joe Montana and I mean then older guys like Johnny Unitas and, you know, dudes like that are fighting for that third spot.
I mean, I don't care about 2, 3, 4, 5. Like, Tom Brady has, like, this is to all football fans, just give Tom Brady the title because his stats will prove you wrong every single day. His production will prove you wrong every single day. So just give Tom Brady the title of being the greatest of all time. There's no need for, I mean, so much debate on this. Like, his stats prove everyone wrong. So
6 Super Bowls is just too overwhelming to deny. I mean, like I said, I have Brady's warmed up to me. This always happens is that I always hate guys like Brady through their whole career. And then as they go into the twilight of their career, I start to appreciate him more. And I get into, like, I just need to watch and appreciate this because I'm watching history every time he plays. So I'm kind of at that point where I don't dislike him anymore. But, man, I hated the Patriots so bad through his whole career. But you just can't deny it, you know. I feel like a little bit of my soul is leaving my body to admit that he's the greatest, but you just can't you can't argue it with a straight face.
I mean, yeah, I everyone knows I'm a diehard Cowboys fan. But they've let me down more than the Canes have. Like, I hate the Cowboys as much as I love them. But my second team, like, beginning in, like, I remember I was at a game in 2003, Patriots at the Dolphins. And Brady hit Troy Brown for a long touchdown in overtime to win the game. And I fell in love with him right there. And so, whenever you want to talk NFL, like, these kind of questions, this is the crap I love. I mean, Tom Brady is just – he's so iconic. Yeah. Didn't have the best arm. Sure as hell wasn't the best athlete. But he just won. He just produced.
Yep. It's kind of funny because Brady – it's hard to say Brady is the best at any one thing. If you look at, like, the different traits of good quarterbacks, you know, like, if you say who had the best arm, well, I mean, it's Marino. And, you know, there's a few guys, but Marino and Elway and Favre, like, these guys had freaking cannons. And then, you know, who was the smartest? Like, oh, that's Peyton Manning for sure. Like, it's hard to pin down what Brady ever did the best.
He just won the most.
Yeah, and it's hard to quantify that, you know. It's hard to say what it is about that caused the winning, but at the end of the day, he just, like you said, 6 Super Bowls, man. You can't argue with that. But, man, I got to go rinse my mouth out after saying all these nice things about Brady.
Good deal, good deal. Great week, man. Great, like, most memorable week of Fours Up so far, and we already got big guests lined up for next week, and so we're going to take a few days off. I'm going to sleep a lot.
Yeah, dude, I've been sleeping, like, including, you know, like 9 hours at night, then I've been taking a nap every day. I wonder if I got this coronavirus or something.
Bro, I am like the opposite. I've been sleeping like crap, but like things like this just motivate me. So, I mean, till next time, brother, like keep killing it. Thank you everyone for the support. We love you guys. Go Canes as always.
Go Canes, man.